With Brand Duga and Heather Fowler. Today, we are delighted to feature Michael Takeda, author of Moth, published by our very own Hot Redhead Media in 2021.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a fun idea. Today, we're drinking the Starry Negroni inspired by Michael's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
Michael Takeda is a writer of speculative fiction that has been called dark by Publishers Weekly and whose gender-bending themes analog as compared to those of Theodore Sturgeon. He has also worked as a translator and teacher of English and Italian language and cinema, had a brief stint as a music reviewer for a local newspaper, PDXS, completed 2 degrees in Italian literature, and has published various novels and other fictions. He currently lives in Worcester, Massachusetts, where he serves as editor-in-chief of Pink Narcissus Press. Author Robert P. O'Toney says of Moth, quote, "Imagine if Jarmusch explored the supernatural more. Take equal parts Only Lovers Left Alive and The Panic in Needle Park. Add a cloak of supernatural uncertainty and raw sexuality, and you have Moth." Vividly realized and set against a Du Maurier-esque backdrop, Takeda weaves a tale that might be one of the best of the year. Wow, strong praise. For our listeners out there, now Ran will give a brief description of the novel.
Young gay heroin addicts in Urbino, Italy have enough problems, but when one of their group connects with a golden stranger who shares a mysterious affliction, a tale about everyday lives riddled with addiction turns into a brutally destructive narrative about sex as a compulsion, coupled with sociopathological transformations. A novel both literary and evocative of the traditional horror of vampire genres, Takeda's Moth straddles the real and the surreal brilliantly, making its own dark magic.
How are you feeling today, Michael?
I'm feeling just fine, thank you.
Well, we're very much looking forward to talking about your work and having you give us a reading a little later. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
No. So thanks for talking me into this, I guess.
Yes, this will be like the ungettable get.
So I'm curious about the origin story of this novel and what inspired you first to start writing it, Michael.
I was thinking you were going to ask me that, and I was hoping that you wouldn't because I don't remember exactly where the kernel for the idea for this novel came from. I started writing it about 20 years ago while I was actually living in Urbino, so that was part of it. And as a scholar of Italian literature, I knew that there was going to be some Dante-esque elements in the book. So, but where I came up with this, I couldn't tell you.
Well, I want to talk about your enormous bookshelf. There are many literary allusions in this book. Can you speak to the mixed reading canon that gave rise to the style of the narrative? Dante, but there's more.
I read probably way more than I should, if that's a thing.
Oh, yeah. I've seen it.
Okay. People always remark on my very big bookshelf when they come into my house. So I read extensively. I read all sorts of things, whether it's speculative fiction or classics or nonfiction or poetry. And, you know, our protagonist is a poet. So I knew I was going to weave in some of the poets that I like. In particular, our protagonist, Moth, his hero is T.S. Eliot. But we do weave in some other things as well. So I know, Heather, you and I have talked about Nabokov all the time. So,
oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Can I write like Nabokov? No. Would I like to? Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, what's such a wonderful thing and something so organic to you as a reader and a writer, I feel, is that you're really kind of bringing all of this reading to the fore, but not just in one genre. So it creates this wonderful kind of, I don't know, experiment of literature that's a blend. That's what I enjoyed so much about Moth as well.
I really enjoyed the setting of the book. I've traveled to Italy a fair amount, and I really liked reading the details of the place and the Italian dialogue. I was curious if you could talk about, as you said that you lived in Urbino, what it was like to set a book there.
living in Urbino, it made sense just to set it there. Urbino, it's a lovely little town. It's a medieval town, and it's surrounded by these Renaissance walls. So it's very much kind of stuck in time, right? Because they can't build outwards. And as I mentioned in the books, a lot of the bars really are underground because they can't spread out. So they have to build down into the basements. They want to do anything new. So I will say that there is no gay bar in Urbino, or at least there certainly wasn't when I was living there at the time. So the locals call it the dive. That part's completely made up. It was very strange being, people did refer to me as the American. You know, it is small enough where people do know each other in Urbino. So it's kind of hard to kind of fit in.
Yeah.
With that sort of, you know.
If there's not a big expat community, there's not a whole lot of people from America living there or weren't when you were there?
No, there were students would come in the summertime to study Italian, but for the rest of the year, it's kind of this almost insular community. So that was kind of interesting.
Well, I enjoyed reading it because I think you did a really great job of giving details of it that enhanced like the narrative of the story.
Oh, yeah. When I first read this as part of the HRM editorial collective, I felt like I was in Europe and I wanted to be back there so bad. I was like, I instantly love this book because it's putting me right where I want to be.
Yep.
So I think that that's a wonderful thing that you've done with the setting there. I don't think it's similar to what you've done with some of your other books, though, in terms of the setting and that sort of thing. How does this book fit in with your longer trajectory? And maybe also speak to what is your favorite thing to write?
If anybody asks me, I tell them I write fantasy. This is my third book published, and none of those three happen to be fantasy. So I like to write different things. I always want to try different things. I like to kind of blend different genres together. My first book was a straight up horror novel with vampires, rock and roll vampires, which is very, very different from my second book, which was a soft sociological sci-fi with shape-shifting aliens. And now there's Moth, which is more of a kind of a gritty, psychological, somewhat literary kind of book. So,
oh, yeah. It really reminded me of Laszlo Krasznahorkai. I don't know if you've read his, but the style of this is definitely quite literary. That's exciting. Do you feel like it's fun to be able to change your voice?
I mean, yes, I do. But sometimes writers kind of get pigeonholed into a certain type of writing. Someone says, oh, I really like this. If you break away from it, they don't like it. So it makes it hard to build any kind of brand as an author if you're changing what you're doing every time.
This is true, but kind of the voice usually tends to unite work, even if it's in disparate genres. I was thinking also because Moth sometimes gets a little bit promoted maybe as a vampiric parallel, but actually it's kind of masterful and cool that you already have a vampire novel. So you still have a fan base from that earlier piece to pull them into this piece. Like, I think there's enough that is of interest that might pull them from one of your books to the next. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does. And I definitely, in both these books, kind of maybe push the boundaries of, we'll say, good taste a little bit. There's a lot of...
What's that?
This is a thing I've heard about.
Some people have it. We don't know.
You know. There's always layers of sex and violence in everything I write. And I have yet to write a book where I've said to my mother, oh, you can read this book. It's always been, okay, mom, I gotta... Don't read it, mom. I have not written a book that my mom, I would like her to read. So we'll see.
I think the only thing of my mom's that she's even read of mine is the fairy tale that you selected for an anthology, what, 20 something years ago?
Something like that, yes.
Yeah. So one story. So I have no danger.
The notion of stasis and change of transformation, those are central themes in your novel for me as I was reading it. And I was curious about what drew you to those ideas. And also when you were drafting the novel, how did you make the decision to place that major transformation where you did, which is pretty far after the halfway mark of the book? So what drew you to the theme? And then as you were like drafting and structuring the novel, what made you make the decision to put that there?
Okay. I would say that the transformation is probably the major theme for me in this book. I mean, it starts off with a character who's named Moth and even talks about the character thinks that he wants to get a tattoo of a moth on his arm, not because he thinks it's a cool insect, but because the idea of transformation is something he's personally interested in. So, and obviously there is the grand transformation, you know, later on in the book for our character. I put it later in the book, probably because I personally like that anticipation of things building up. If it had come early, it would have been a little maybe anticlimactic for me anyway.
I agree. And that's definitely the effect that it had on me as a reader for the first time.
But yeah. I mean, it does start where he meets the stranger in the very first scene. And that's where it starts building, you know, this mystery behind the stranger, what's going on. And as we go in, it gets a little more strange and more people get drawn into the mystery.
I love that. And I also love that it seems like that element of transformation or of an arc is following the idea of addiction as well as kind of the actual events for the characters. And I think I've mentioned this to you before, Michael, but I really like what this book does in terms of the heroin addicts. What first drew me toward it as part of the collective was how personable these addicts are, how likable and human. And interestingly, though it feels like it's set back maybe in the 80s, it felt like there was a direct parallel to how necessary books like this are when there's this opium epidemic going on right now. So I just wanted to praise you for that, but also see if you agree. I mean, I feel like maybe the image in popular culture of addicts has been scarier, maybe more soulless, more negative, since this book provides a narrative of addiction, both in its real space and in its magical space. Were you deliberate in using it as an instrument to destigmatize addiction?
You know, that wasn't necessarily my intention to do any, you know, I wasn't trying to present these addicts in necessarily a good light because none of them are necessarily good people, but they're real people. And if you look at the character of Orazio.
Oh, I love him.
Okay. He's sort of an amalgamation of Italian junkies that I did know. Not a perfect guy, and he definitely would help an old lady across the street so then he could steal her purse in order to feed his addiction, but he still has a good heart. You know, he still has some good qualities to him. A lot of these characters are based on people that I've actually known in the past. My day job, I work as a nurse, and I've worked in a detox where most of my clients have either an opiate addiction or alcohol or, you know, some other drug problem. And it's very interesting how different all of these people are. There's not just one type of addict. You can have people from all walks of life who get sucked into this substance abuse problem. And
especially when the prescriptions of pills were causal to a lot of these addictions. I mean, that was a different image for opium addiction than I think had been depicted in film or in books as often. Can you speak to if there were any books or films that may have influenced this? It's amazing to hear that it's about real people, and that's exactly how you feel as a reader. That's probably why the characters are so compelling. But were there other things in your image repertoire that you were maybe drawing on even a little bit?
I think at the time in the 90s, I was reading pretty much every book I could get my hands on, whether it was a memoir by someone who had gone through opiate addiction, several novels I've read. Requiem for a Dream was probably one of the most brutal.
Oh, yeah.
And was probably one of the bigger influences for this book.
Yeah, I can see that. I was interested in the point of view shift on the last couple of pages in the novel. I really liked the voice throughout the whole novel, but I was wondering about your decision to shift that point of view in the last couple of pages, and also if you had considered any other point of view options when you were drafting it.
It's a little dangerous when your protagonist has the same name as you. So, and I thought maybe I should change that. Maybe his name should be Bob. No.
But I don't know about Bob, though.
I don't know Bob. Well, it would explain why he has a nickname. Maybe he doesn't like to be called Bob.
Mm-hmm.
I've said in the past, this is probably the most autobiographical book ever written. And of course, as an author, you get to take your experiences and fictionalize them and tweak them and do all sorts of things to them. So I knew Moth was kind of my main character. Of course, you get kind of this point of view also from Arturo, who is he's more or less the polar opposite of Moth, right? He's done everything right. He's a good guy. He's gone to school. He's going to get married to this wonderful girl. He's got his life together. And then his life starts unraveling as well. because of meeting Moth. So,
and because he's so together, that's why he gets, I shouldn't say anything. No spoiler. Michael, can you tell us your ideal reader for this book, if I may be so reductive?
Not my mother. Okay.
Who else did you imagine maybe writing this for, or who could you see reading this book?
I was pitching it when I was shopping it around as a horror novel, or at least as a psychological horror novel. And you said, no, it's not. So I think
I rejected that outright.
So I was thinking it was more geared towards people who liked horror, but I did want it to have a little more. I find a lot of horror novels aren't very well written. I'm not naming any names of any famous horror writers.
No, true. I mean, it's the quality of the language that creates the literary title or literary idea of it being connected in that way, right?
Yeah. So I did want to write a horror novel that was maybe a little more literary, with elevating the language a little bit and maybe elevating the themes a little bit. So, but I still think it was still a horror novel, and the people who liked reading horror might like this book as well. I mean, it definitely does our monster, our antagonist, or whatever, the stranger, whatever you want to call him. He's not a vampire, but there's something vampiric about what he does.
Right.
So yep. Perhaps people who do like vampire novels are looking for something maybe a little different. They might like this book as well.
Yeah. And I want to make sure that I'm not being reductive at all about genre readers who are very smart and savvy. And in fact, a little scary. I'm not going to lie. Like, you're at a convention or something, and if you're the author, 4 books later, you made a mistake or you changed something about a character, and they will call you on that. So it's very interesting. I could see this book having a readership that's kind of all over the board, although it is a little risque. So maybe not for the under 18 crowd. Would you agree with that? Or not publicly for the under 18 crowd?
I think you need to be at least 30 to read this book. That's we'll set the bar higher for that. No. Definitely not a family-friendly kind of novel, no.
So you work as an author and an editor and a publisher, and I was interested on how changing those hats work in your world, and which one of those roles is the more satisfying or the more time-consuming for you?
Before I started getting into publishing and editing books, and I try not to edit our books. I have editors who I'd rather do that. But we've put together some anthologies, and I've been editing stories, and there was a couple novels I did edit. And then I found the more editing I did, the more critical I became, the harder it became for me to actually write something, because I was overthinking everything.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And it was less of a joy to write, you know, freely. So I feel like I lost a little bit of that joy that I used to get from just making up stories and writing them down and not really worrying about editorial kinds of things. But now it's hard to separate editor from writer.
It's hard to shut that part of your brain off.
It's hard to shut it off.
Yeah. Once you've done it, it's just open. Yeah. Interesting.
Do you feel like if you're working in multiple genres that sometimes different genres also inform what you can or can't shut off when you're doing your writing? I know I've been recently in the last year writing nonstop screenplays. So oddly, when I bring that back to my short fiction, I find I'm lopping the crap out of the sentences.
No, actually, I don't. I can kind of jump between different things.
Cool. Well, in Moth, I was struck by how long the characters kind of stayed with me, above and beyond the conceit of the book's supernatural plot movement. And for me, like you were saying, oh, you rejected that. Yes, I did. Because as I was reading this book, so many things were occurring to me on so many levels, one of which was this exploration of identity and how it was kind of, I don't want to call it exactly concealed, but it was like under the layer of a novel that straddles literary and genre work, which, by the way, I love, 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 love. If you had to pick one, what do you think is this book's central theme?
As we mentioned before, I think the theme of transformation is probably the main theme. We really have a character here who is, he's kind of lost. He doesn't really fit in anywhere. He's a guy who keeps wandering around from place to place. He doesn't feel like he fits in. He's an outsider. He grew up in the Midwest in presumably a small town in the 80s. He's gay. He felt like he couldn't come out of the closet. He didn't feel like he belonged anywhere. So he's just kind of floating through life. And maybe he had it together, but once he got into heroin, things kind of went downhill for him. However, you know, he was still a person. There was still hope, except he meets this stranger. He makes some bad decisions, and then things start spiraling out of control for him. And then it's really a question of, can he hold on to his humanity, or is he going to become a monster?
I love that element of the monster versus the human on a lot of different layers. So fascinating. Well, we are really looking forward to hearing you read from an excerpt of Moth. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Our cocktail today is called the Starry Negroni, and the recipe's on the blog if you'd like to make one and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here are the ingredients. It's 1 ounce of gin, 1 ounce of Campari, 1 ounce of sweet vermouth, and a little orange peel. And the thing that makes it really cool is that we put these gold glitter stars on the top. So it's a really beautiful drink.
Yeah, I love it. I have them floating on my cocktail right now. Great. So, Michael, is there anything you'd like to tell us about the passage you're sharing today?
This passage came kind of in the middle of the book. I thought it'd be a good introduction to our various junkies and miscellaneous folks involved. And I think I'm just going to leave it at that.
Awesome. Take it away.
Night in front of the dive. He wonders what he's doing on the threshold, neither inside nor out, on the border. No one's around, so he speaks aloud. What am I doing here? As if speaking the words aloud would clarify the situation. They don't clarify shit. He still doesn't know. The stranger flits through his mind, tugging at him the way water draws the rod, or the moon, the tide. Moth is liquid, swirling, churning all around himself. He briefly touches his right wrist, tracing the tail of his dragon, as if checking to see if it's still under his skin or has somehow vanished like a watch in a drug deal. He is liquid on a slope, being pulled down. Water in a basin being sucked through a drain. He feels drawn to the dive, but he resists. Someone once said that resistance is futile. He can't remember who said that. He's about to step through the door of the club when Orazio, followed by Juan, steps out. Orazio has the reckless air about him of someone who is very high on junk and seems too pleased to see Moth, a sparkling slash of a smile blooming out of his lips. Hey, what are you doing? I was just about to go in, Moth admits. Orazio and Juan exchange a glance, thick as thieves, smug. You don't want to go in there, Orazio says. No, you don't want to go in there, Juan echoes. Moth has the sense of being outside of something. Is there anyone in there? He asks. Nah, no one, Orazio says. Not even a dog. He fumbles in his jacket for a cigarette. Well, the only dog was Juan. Yeah, I was the only dog, Juan agrees. In English, Orazio says, the big dog. What? Juan asks. Moth translates. Oh, right, Juan says. Woof. Anyway, no one's down there, Orazio repeats. Thursday night, Juan says, everyone's down at the portico. Is that where you're going? Moth asks. Yeah, Sam's supposed to be down there, Orazio says. You coming? Moth considers. Unable to make his own decision, letting someone else make the decision for him seemed like the reasonable thing to do. Yeah, sure. Orazio starts moving suddenly, as if he'd been jump-started. Okay, let's go, he says decisively, more to the street in front of him than to the men behind him. Dog-like, Moth and Juan trail after him. Within moments, Orazio is several paces ahead of them, not looking back. Juan gives Moth a sharp, sober look. I'd keep an eye on your friend there if I were you. Moth's gaze flickers towards Orazio, moving with less bounce and more purpose in his stride. What do you mean? Let's just say that certain people tend to exaggerate sometimes. Ah, Moth says. So he's been appointed the new babysitter. He considers Juan for a moment. And are you ever victim to the tendency to exaggerate? Juan smiles. Sam's right. He said that you're not so keen on making statements as you are on posing questions. Don't you ever just make a statement? I make my statements in other ways. Huh, I understand what you mean, Juan says. Orazio glances over his shoulder and calls back, come on! Yes, sir, Juan says. They arrive at the portico. The bar is already crowded. All arcs and pale stone, Moth thinks that it must have been a wine cellar before it was transformed into a bar. They weave among the bodies and the techno throb to find Sam and Lisa sharing a cloudy-looking cocktail, sickly green like flue phlegm, in one of the alcoves. Greetings and some conversation. Moth doesn't feel like talking, so he lights a cigarette and watches the people on the dance floor. He realizes that he'd rather not be here, but at the same time, he has nowhere else to go. At some point, Orazio places a glass of wine in his hand, so he drinks it. Then Orazio disappears. 10 minutes later, Orazio comes back. "I've got to go," Orazio shouts at the group over the music. Before he can run off, Moth stops him, leaning closer to the younger man's ear. "Where are you going?" "The dive. I'll be back in 10 minutes. "I'll go with you." Orazio gives him a suspicious look, causing him to add, "I don't want to stay here." Orazio waves to the others and leaves with Moth. Outside, he realizes how steamy and claustrophobic the portico was when the cool air and black sky strike him. "Hey, I'll only be at the dive for a minute," Orazio reveals. "Yeah, fine," Moth says, now keeping up with his friend's quick pace. "What were you and Juan doing?" "Nothing," Orazio says. "I just ran into him at the dive for like 5 minutes, then we left." "Well, that's strange." Orazio turns his head. "What's strange?" "Juan told me that I should keep an eye on you." Orazio makes a face like a bug that flew into his mouth. "Oh, fuck him," he mutters. "He does that. Tries to be everybody's mother. I mean, how many mothers does a guy need?" "One," Moth says. "Although Juan might look good in a house dress." Orazio considers this and laughs. "How about a tight leather skirt? Blood red lipstick. Stiletto heels. And a pink lace bra." They burst out laughing. "Fishnet stockings," Orazio adds, and they laugh again. They arrive at the dive. "What do you need to do here?" Moth asks. "See a guy," Orazio says, in a way that Moth understands that it is drug and not sex related. "Are you coming in or will you wait here?" Like sex, drug deals are also a private act. "I'll just wait inside at the bar," Moth says. "All right." Orazio leaves Moth at the bar and gestures to a guy waiting at a table, junkie written all over him. Moth watches as they exchange a few words, then the junkie gets up from the table and follows Orazio out the back. He could time the transaction. 2 minutes. He looks at his naked wrist from habit still. A voice hums in his ear. "It's 1:10. Moth doesn't dare turn. Instead, he raises his eyes to the mirror behind the bar and sees the stranger beside him. The stranger meets his gaze in the mirror and smiles a diabolic smile, which causes the sluggish blood in Moth's veins to race. Moth doesn't turn, unable to break the contact established in the looking glass. "What are you doing here?" The stranger leans closer. Moth feels the thick black hair of the stranger brush against his face as he sees it reflected. "I was looking for you." "I mean," Moth starts and then hesitates. His throat is blocked. He swallows slowly. "The cops are looking for you." "So I've read," the stranger says. "Did you think I wouldn't read the papers? Is that what you thought? Is that why you talked?" Along with Moth's desire, a dread is growing. I didn't talk," he manages. "You're a liar," the stranger says. His voice is calm, deep, smooth. "Do you know what they do to liars in some places? They rip out the offending tongue." Moth watches as the stranger's pale hand flashes through the dark to Moth's mouth, the fingers infiltrating, filling Moth's mouth with a bitter taste of which he's aware for only a brief moment before he is overwhelmed by the throb of pleasure which rages through his body as before, growing fast and furious, his stomach hot, limbs heavy, cock straining against his jeans on the brink of an orgasm. The stranger suddenly removes his hand from within Moth's mouth. Moth's senses return to him slowly. "I didn't talk," he repeats. The stranger takes hold of Moth's jacket, jerking Moth to face him. He stares into Moth's eyes for a moment, then releases him. "Good," he says. Moth's breath rushes out of him. "Come on," the stranger says. "There's something I want to do to you." The warning bell that has been steadily ringing in Moth's head since the beginning of this encounter intensifies. Moth ignores it. "Oh yeah?" The stranger smiles again, filling Moth with a longing, unbearable in its intensity. "I'm going to fuck you to death." Moth's mind shuts down, and then the blur. His body follows the stranger out into Rat's Alley, into a particularly dark alcove, limp as water under the touch of the stranger. He shivers and throbs, tension stiffening his body as the stranger runs his tongue up his neck. His balls aching, Moth clings to the pale white neck, pulling the stranger closer. With the stranger's mouth against his own, Moth explodes in an orgasm as violent as the last, his groans caught in the stranger's mouth. Weak-kneed, he clings to the slim body of the stranger, a bitter taste in his mouth, like the taste of heroin. Heroin, yes, that's what it's like. But he cannot think about this. He cannot think about anything, lost in the demand of his body to have more. Hands skim his naked skin as the stranger pushes up his shirt, then tongue to aching nipple, the left one. The tug of the stranger's teeth on his nipple ring sends him into another spasm, waves of painful pleasure, which still do not satisfy the desperate need. His head spins, thick as muck, unbearable and terrible and wonderful. He is liquid in the arms of the stranger, sloshing everywhere in a raging torrent of desire. Hot breath against his ear, the stranger asks, "Do you want me?" Moss thoughts are honey, sticky and thick. He wants. There exists nothing but this need. Want, he gasps. The loosening of his belt. Already, Moth has disappeared. Moth has ceased to exist. Aware of the increasing need, the demand, the penetration being taken against the wall, his empty orgasms improbably bursting out, rolling out one after the other, his body burns, melts, is all, is nothing. He doesn't feel the cold stone against his hands, nor the cold air against his skin. He drowns within the sensation. His heart weakens. He stops breathing. Then a sharp stab within his bowels, a hot, fast, metallic pain like a knife puncture in his gut. But he has no breath with which to cry out, no strength to force the air out of his lungs. He is choking with the pain, but only for a moment before a flood of sweet darkness enfolds him, and whatever was left of him slips away into the vast black nothing.
Oh, such a great reading. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Wow, a really compelling passage. I was totally in the lure of it. To me, when I heard you read today, I was feeling like there's this really Luke's feel to the erotic prose in Moth. Mm. How do you feel about sexplicit work in fiction? Do you love, I just neologized that, sexplicit. I feel like literary fiction shuts the door more often than not, maybe too often. Do you feel horror goes there more regularly? And how was your decision to bring more erotic content into this work made?
You know, I feel like there's definitely a separation between erotica and all other kinds of writing. And there's still some taboos against explicit sexual content in what we would call regular books. I think that any erotic kind of content, it's difficult to write it well without it being silly or maybe over the top. So, you know, I'm always kind of looking for that balance where it's not ridiculous, but it's still compelling.
You don't want people to read a passage and laugh or something of that nature, right?
Exactly.
Well, I'm really interested in the content, the erotic content of this book, particularly because the 80s, it feels like the 80s, maybe early 90s setting of the book seems to juxtapose the toxin of the supernatural characters with that of kind of a then nascent AIDS epidemic. Did you intend that association and maybe sexualize the narrative a little bit even more to bring that kind of feeling or connotation to the reader?
The book is set probably somewhere at the turn of the century, and you know, I feel really old saying turn of the century, meaning the year 2000. Whereas growing up, the turn of the century was 1900. But yeah, so our character, he hits puberty in the mid 80s, which was when AIDS started making an appearance, and they were calling it the gay disease at the time. So it's somewhere a little kind of maybe late 90s.
Yeah. And I really respect that you're dealing with a lot of gay characters and you're bringing a lot of different aspects of relationships to the fore with this. Was that also a goal you had when you were working on it?
I knew that I wanted this book to be just brimming with gay. So.
Well, it is. I want to come back to something we talked about a little bit earlier. As we chatted about it, the book is compared to or similar in some ways to vampire narratives, though not strictly vampiric in its contents, for example, with a sexy stranger who becomes the danger. Were you nodding to vampiric narratives or winking at its fans as you wrote this? Were you conscious of that?
I definitely was. If we're avoiding spoilers, it's kind of hard to talk about. The mechanism of transmission is a little bit similar to a vampire, but instead of our stranger taking something he's sort of giving something. So I've kind of reversed this idea.
Oh, he's not
taking, he's not taking, he's giving something else.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow. Crazy. So that's really fun. I didn't even think about that, Michael. This book actually feels like four different genres to me. It feels like literary fiction, like horror, somewhat like magical realism, and also a little bit of a touch of erotic fiction when you think about it, all of it all together. So that's fascinating.
We have one last question for you. And I always like to ask what you've learned on your path to becoming an author and what advice you'd offer to new writers, both those working in speculative and literary fiction.
This is not groundbreaking advice, but read. You hear this all the time that if you're a writer, you should read and you should read all sorts of things. And some people say you can't write anything original anymore, but what you can do is kind of take from here and there and blend it together in your own way to create something that's different. So that would be my advice.
That's excellent advice.
Okay, we lied. There's one more question at least. So what I'd like to know is what's next for you? I mean, what do you imagine creating? What do you think is in your writing future in the next 5 years?
So I had started writing Moth probably in the year 1999, 2000, around there. And then it sat in a proverbial drawer gathering dust, like most of the things I write. So I have a whole drawer full of things that are unfinished. I always think I want to finish them, but I would definitely like to go back to writing some fantasy, I think. Short stories. I would like to put together a collection of stories about gay elves, because I think we need more gay elves in the world.
Oh my gosh, that would be great.
What is your website? Isn't your website have something elves in the name of it?
Yes, it's Elves from Iceland.
Well, see, there you go. There's your collection, Gay Elves from Iceland.
Indeed,
so I'm just making that up. Yeah, so how many stories and things are you sitting on right now? Like, what do you have in the background that we could maybe expect to be released at some future date?
Like most fantasy writers, I do have epic saga of 10 million books set in a fantasy world that hasn't come together. I was writing more gay stuff set in fantasy worlds. I have vampires in space. I mean, you name it, I probably have it somewhere unfinished.
This sounds great. This sounds great. It reminds me in screenwriting of what they call high concept, because you have all these wonderful concepts. And I know that you received an inquiry from someone about whether the movie rights had been sold to Moth. Okay, this is just an out of the blue question, but can you imagine Moth becoming a movie? And if so, could you even imagine which director you would love to see doing something with it and or which actors?
I think I already know which director I want. There's an Italian director. His name is Luca Guadagnino, which is hard to pronounce even for me. He did the remake of Suspiria. He did Call Me By Your Name, and he did a brilliant film called Io Sono L'Amore, I Am Love, with Tilda Swinton, which was everything he does is so fantastic and so layered. And because it takes place in Italy, I think he would be my dream director. As for actors, I don't know. I hadn't thought about it. Orazio would definitely have to be a very bouncy, dynamic kind of character, I think.
Oh, I love him. I love him so much. Yeah. And do you imagine this being, hypothetically, now I'm just already picturing the movie for the book. Do you imagine this being filmed in Italian, or would you have it be done for an American audience in English or in Italian with subtitles even as possible these days with all the streaming platforms?
You know, when I wrote the book and I wrote the dialogue for the book, in my head, the dialogue was in Italian. And then I wrote it in English. And then I looked back at it and I said, wow, this English is really bad, because it was kind of a direct machine translation. But then I had to go and tweak the English to make it sound a little more normal. So either language would be fine with me.
Yeah. Well, that'd be wonderful if that happens. I like thinking about it. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today. We really enjoy talking with you and hearing you read from your work.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes. And everybody, please order Michael's book, Moth, from Hot Redhead Media, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on booktales, readings, and drinks. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversations with amazing authors. Thanks again for listening to BookTales. See you next time.